When a client slips into a posture of shame, how can we help bring them back? Dr. Peter Levine has studied the ways that we manifest feelings in our body. One thing he found is that a posture can have a direct effect on how a person experiences emotions. Here, Peter shows how shame transforms the body and a practical way to release it.
What you see in shame is a very particular body posture and autonomic pattern. It's actually fairly similar to what you see in trauma, which is, I think, also one of the reasons, and I don't think people really appreciate how important this is, that whenever a person is traumatized, even if it wasn't in an interpersonal dynamic, an interpersonal relationship, because the posture of collapse is very similar in trauma as it is in shame, so you see the two of them fit together. You see that aversion of gaze, of looking away, of not wanting to be in contact with another person, because again, the pain of the shame is so devastatingly intense. Actually, there's some recent data. I was just teaching a class together with Bessel here in Zurich, Bessel van der Kolk, and some very interesting fMRI. If you show a person a picture of a friendly face, it lights up in the prefrontal cortex. So in other words, you say, okay, well, that's a friendly face. That's nice. That feels good. Now, if you play that same face to somebody who's traumatized, or I would say add, or is in shame, the frontal lobe actually shuts down, and the periaqueductal gray in the brainstem lights up, and that's the part of the brainstem that's used with fear and terror and paralysis, immobility. So if you, and this is a mistake often therapists make, they'll see that the client is in shame, and they try to be kindly, they try to be supportive, try to somehow make them feel better. But if you look back at that study, what happens when you do that is they just shut down even more and go even more into the shame. And then sometimes the therapist tries even more to get them out of the shame, which forces them back into the shame. So it's a difficult situation. And without understanding that, therapists can easily actually increase the level of shame. What I generally do when I work with a client is I work with two chairs, and they're kind of facing out at about 45 degrees. So the client can either be completely in their own space, or if they choose, they can make contact with me. But it's not, they're not forced to do that. Because if you're looking face to face, there's no way of getting away from that. So that's one of the things that therapists can do, is be aware of how they arrange their seating, and to be aware of then what happens if they try to make contact with a person who's in a state of shame. There are so many approaches to shame, but this most relevant, beneficial, has to do with the posture of shame. When I started to really think about shame and how to work with it, it was about 1972, 1974, and I spent a lot of my life at the graduate library at UC Berkeley, the catacombs, the stacks, and this was of course way before computers. And I came across a book by a woman named Nina Bull called The Attitude Theory of Emotion. And what she showed was actually really remarkable. And when I read this, I said, my God, that's exactly what I'm seeing with my clients as I was beginning to develop the SE work. And what she would do is she would give a person a particular emotion. They would either visualize it or even the word, so fear or anger. And then the person would report what they were noticing, what sensation they were noticing in their body. And then there was also an observer who was also writing down what they observed in the person's posture. This is, I think, one of the most elegant experiments done. And sadly, almost nobody knows about Nina Bull's work. She would put the person in an emotion, and then she would lock in that emotion in something you could say called light hypnosis. I would call it action imagery or motor imagery, postural imagery. And as long as the person was locked in that posture, you could give them any other, you could say, okay, if they were in fear, so give them joy, give them anger, give them surprise, whatever you gave them, they could not feel that emotion as long as the posture was locked in the emotion, say, of shame. And so I started to realize that when a person is in the posture of shame, that until you change the posture, the shame affect will continue. So what I would do is I would first, you know, again, not face the person. And often I wouldn't even say anything about shame. And I might start by saying, you know, I'd like to do a little exercise with you if you're willing. And here's what I'd like to have you do. I'd like you have you follow me, follow what I'm doing with my body. And so what I would do is I would, again, feel the quality of shame and allow my body to fall into this helpless collapse. But then I would encourage them actually to see if they can very delicately increase that posture. But then to notice where it seemed to rest and maybe even wanted to come back in the other direction. So they would be in a shutdown posture like this, and the experience is of no energy and hopeless, helpless. And then as they would very slowly, and again, it's not a matter of getting up, because a lot of times people with shame try to change their bodies in a way so that they won't be feeling the shame, but the shame is there all the same. You see that in narcissistic individuals. Just doing that, the person starts to notice, oh my God, I feel better. I feel energy coming back. I feel more sense of aliveness. I feel tingly. The polarity of shame is pride or triumph. And when you gradually have the person come into this new posture, as with Nina Bull's experiment, and the chest really opens, you feel a sense of pride, a sense of goodness, a sense of triumph. Then, from that vantage, you can look at the shame and kind of dissect it and work with it.
Peter made a comment early in his talk, a warning about not approaching a client's shame with kindness. It's a small adjustment that can have a tremendous impact. To get some more perspective on this, let's hear from Dr. Ron Siegel, Dr. Kelly McGonigal, and Bill O'Hanlon.
My friend Chris Germer, we had edited a book on wisdom and compassion psychotherapy, and he's done a lot of subsequent work on self-compassion, and he uses the term backdraft to refer yes. to what goes wrong here. And it comes from firefighting, and that when a firefighter opens the door to a room where there's a flame, oftentimes that opening of the door lets in oxygen, and then there's a huge conflagration and things get quite out of control in that moment. And I think we therapists run into that a fair amount of the time, where we move toward the pain. And I think we run into it particularly around shame, because while ultimately air and light is what will cure shame, in the short run, when you bring air and light into shame, it flares up, because it is so painful for people to be seen as being in their shame. Eventually, I think we move to a point where we can feel it, acknowledge it, and bathe it in self-compassion and compassion from the therapist, others, and air and light is healing. But we've got to pace ourselves.
Yeah, you know, I think the idea of something that we normally train ourselves to do and train our graduate students to do being inadvertently harmful is a really important point to talk about. In addition to wisdom and compassion, I would add timing, as you have. Mm-hmm. I think timing really matters. And sometimes the overstimulation the experience is overstimulating for someone, as well as making them feel vulnerable and weak at a time when they maybe aren't ready, aren't able to feel that, and don't have a good enough rapport.
I've heard Marsha Linehan talk about this also, that, you know, that in many ways, a big frustration of hers around psychotherapists generally treating people who are very emotionally volatile, you know, folks we might call having borderline personality disorder, is that, you know, therapists are most comfortable leading with love. And it's sometimes destabilizing for that population as well. And it makes sense. That population typically has a lot of trauma history and not a lot of secure attachment history.
Ruth Lanius used to talk about people who have early childhood trauma and neglect have a hard time with eye contact, and that if you look at them in the eye, they feel known and disgusted, and the sense of disgust, and really find it way too hard to tolerate. And so this whole, I guess it makes me think, you know, anyone who thinks they can do therapy without the training really is unwise, because there are so many ways that a good idea is a good idea when it's a good idea and not at other times.
And this is where Peter Levine's structural intervention of, you know, let's sit at a 45 degree angle is a very nice idea, because it allows more flexibility and allows the client to take the lead in showing us just how much intimacy they would like at this moment.
And they can control the space. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You were going to say something.
That came to mind is we know that the function of eye contact in supportive or, you know, positive social interactions, part of what it does is it starts to trigger the release of oxytocin and other neurohormones that help people bond. And that doesn't always happen with people who have a history of trauma or abuse. But it's more likely to happen with an animal than with a human. And I think about these great studies showing the benefit of gazing at a dog or gazing at a horse's eye. And can you make eye contact with both horses' eyes at the same time? I don't know. I haven't worked with equine therapy. But it makes me think about what a powerful practice that is for many people who've experienced abuse or trauma. That first, the ability to accept a loving gaze or accepting gaze could come from an animal first.
Yeah, so I've had experience with this. I had a client who was really deeply ashamed and felt inadequate in almost all situations. She was in a position, I don't want to say the specifics of it, but everyone expected things from her, and some of them were bound to be disappointed, and that would just drive her deeply into shame. And then she would function less well, and then she'd get more criticism. So it was a really bad spiral she was in. She was in danger of losing her job because of it. And I didn't realize it at first, but I'd seen her for a few weeks, And she used to go into this kind of withdrawal where she would sit in the chair in the therapy room and she would almost go into an infant-like withdrawal. She would just pull into herself, not suck her thumb, but it looked like she was doing that. She's just going back to almost infancy, kind of protecting herself when we would talk every once in a while. And then it would take her a few minutes to kind of come out of it, and it would really interrupt the therapeutic flow. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, I realized something I was doing was triggering that. And it was that I'm a fairly optimistic person. And I tell stories, as I mentioned. And I would tell that my stories all had this structure. Somebody was having a great difficulty. They would struggle, and then they would find themselves in a better place. And right after I told the story, maybe 3 or 4 minutes, she would start to pull into herself and go into that very fetal kind of thing. And I said to her, you know, I think that my stories are triggering this for you. And she hadn't realized it. She just felt it. And then she said, I think you're right. Because as soon as I hear one of those stories, I think I'm not going to be a good enough client for you. I'm not going to be like those people. I'm never going to get there. And you're going to be disappointed in me. And it would trigger her shame. And so I started telling stories about people who are stuck and people who weren't doing well. And she straightened right up and felt really good. And I was like, oh, I have to adjust my style, because somehow inadvertently, even though I was trying to support her, I was shaming, I was triggering the shame in some way. I had to adjust my usual style. And that was a great learning for me, is that what usually works with people, because for most people that's really helpful, was the exact opposite. She was so driven by and run by and hurt by shame that anything I said that she could compare herself to would drive her deeper into shame. Very useful learning for me.
I appreciated those different views on safe ways to approach a person's shame. Now, a shame posture can also be connected to trauma. So in the next module, we'll look at one unconventional way to work with trauma-based shame. I'll see you there.